Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. It's our Friday roundup of the week's events. And coming up later in the program, we'll talk about the Indiana General Assembly with Matt Tully of the Indianapolis Star. The 2011 session ends tonight. Tony Kahns with the Courier-Journal will join us later to discuss some Jefferson County public schools issues. Right now, Metro News and also some news from around Kentucky. And in the studio is most of the WFPL news team assembled. Gabe Bullard, Dalton Main, and Philip Bailey. Welcome, everyone.
Hi.
Hey.
Philip, let's start with you and the ethics case against Metro Councilwoman Judy Green. A long-awaited, for some, hearing was held yesterday. It's the first of two. And first of all, what complaint was dealt with in yesterday's hearing?
Well, this hearing dealt with the first complaint that was filed by Ray Barker Sr., a former political opponent of Councilman Green's. It deals specifically with the issues surrounding the summer jobs program that she created, the Green Clean Team. It essentially charges that the councilwoman, that members of her family benefited directly from the program. The Ethics Commission added last month nepotism to the charges. So among those, that was really the bulk of the discussion and bulk of the testimony from yesterday's hearing that lasted all day. It started at 9:30 and went until about 4 or 5 o'clock. And Councilman Green spent most of the morning on the stand testifying before the Ethics Commission.
And how's the setup? This is like a court trial, right?
It's very much like a trial. The investigative officer acts as the prosecutor, the investigative officer being Attorney James Earhart. The defense for Councilwoman Green, Attorney Brent Kent Wicker, mm-hmm. and Stephen S. Reed are her attorneys. And the hearing officer is the retired judge who is acting as the judge for the trial. And the commission members also get to ask questions. So they, although they act as a jury, unlike a jury, they get to ask questions just like the council does.
So Councilwoman Green testified. Who else was on the stand?
Other key testimony came from Dr. Eddie Woods, the founder of the Life Institute, which was the fiscal agent of the Green Clean Team in 2009. Also, there was a young man who was a participant in the Green Clean Team who said he benefited from the program, that it taught him job and other life skills. Miss Diane Samwaru, a paralegal in Mr. Wicker's office who went over some of the details of who got paid the most and was critical of the audit conducted by the city. And there was another woman who I think her testimony was disqualified because a lot of her testimony was deemed irrelevant to the case from the hearing standpoint.
And Ray Barker, who filed the complaint, as you may have said, has run for Councilwoman Green's seat on at least one occasion, right?
Yeah, well, he's run for District 1 twice. He ran in 2006 when incumbent Leonard Watkins was the council member. Councilwoman Green, who was a candidate at the time, also ran for that seat. She won. She beat Leonard Watkins and Mr. Barker pretty decisively at that time. And then last year in the Democratic primary for the first district, Councilwoman Green faced Mr. Barker again and beat him decisively again. That was a point that the councilman's defense attorneys certainly hit on, that this is politically motivated, that Mr. Barker was using this to gain political points, perhaps to use in a future election campaign against Councilman Green.
So this hearing is over. What happens now with this particular case?
Well, now once the transcripts are finished, the hearing officer will take all that and submit the findings of fact and law to the Ethics Commission. He has, I believe, 30 days to do that. Upon that, the Ethics Commission will then have an up or down vote, or the seven members will, and they will determine whether this is no violation, which the charges would be completely dismissed, or if they decide that Councilwoman Green is guilty of an ethics violation. There are two tracks. There's the unintentional track, and there's the intentional violation track. The unintentional track, I think the worst thing is just a letter of reprimand. But on the intentional violation track, there's a letter of censure, there's a fine, and there's the recommendation to the council for removal of office. It could be one of, if not all of those combinations, and that would lead us. The council would then make that decision to remove from office. Only the Metro Council members can make that decision. But then that would lead us into the second hearing.
And what complaint does that deal with?
The second hearing complaint was filed by a community activist and blogger, Ed Springsteen. It deals with a different issue. It alleges that the councilwoman circumvented and broke council rules when she rerouted funds or instructed a nonprofit organization, 100 Black Men, to reroute funds to other nonprofit organizations that weren't listed on the original application. That is clearly against council rules. So Mr. Springsteen says that he filed that complaint because he saw that Mr. Barker was the only one who was standing up on this issue. That hearing has been rescheduled. Initially, it was thought that these two hearings were going to be combined. The Ethics Commission slated today and yesterday and today for a hearing, but they decided, because it was a different case and other circumstances, including gathering more information that Mr. Earhart needed to gather, that the trial has been rescheduled to May 23rd.
So is it possible the commission could have two separate rulings on these? They won't combine these?
No, these will be two separate rulings, mm-hmm. Which means the council may, in fact, wait after the second hearing to make any decision on what it will do, depending on the severity of the Ethics Commission's decision.
What is the process if it's decided that by a council member, or what is the process for her being removed by the council?
Well, there are two tracks for that. The one track is the mayor of Louisville could recommend removal, and then the council members would like an impeachment trial, and you would have to have 2/3, I believe, vote, and that would be cause for removal. The other track is that the 5 members or more of the council must call for a removal of a member. Those members will be disqualified from voting, and then there would be a trial-like process where you would have to have a majority vote of those remaining members, and if they were to vote, that member would be removed. Now, that member can, whoever is subject to removal, can appeal that to circuit court, and that would delay the process a little bit further. But it's a pretty clear-cut process if you want to remove a council member. That's never been done. I do know that the Metro Council has retained special counsel on this matter to ask them, to advise them on what they can and can't say legally to not derail the process, either in Councilman Green's favor or against her.
And she maintains that she has not broken the law, at least intentionally, and she defended herself in testimony yesterday.
Yes. Her attorney, Kent Wicker, in his closing statement made it clear that no good deed goes unpunished. They feel that the councilwoman is a youth advocate who is being maligned by a political opponent who has gotten far too much negative attention in the press. They contend that she's not being judged on being a great bookkeeper, but that her heart was in the right place. It appeared that Mr. Wicker was making that argument, that it was an unintentional mistake that she had made in not obtaining an opinion from the Ethics Commission to whether her husband should have been involved in running the program. That was revealed. But what was surprising was that this issue of the reimbursements. During the process, Mr. Earhart's questioning, it was revealed that Councilman Green had been given $4,000 in cash by the Life Institute for repaying her for a loan that she had given the nonprofit to cover the second payroll to pay the youth participants. Mr. Earhart asked for documentation of both how did that loan process itself and the receipt that she got back for the cash. Councilman Green said that she had lost the receipt, that she did not have it, that she supposedly held, she said that she held on to the money, even though she went on a vacation not too long after to Myrtle Beach with her family. That raised many a number of eyebrows, and that raised many questions about whether or not this process was on the up and up, in the sense that not only did Councilman Green give a cash loan to the nonprofit, to the Life Institute, but that she received cash back for that loan, and that there is no documentation for either.
I see, and finally, excuse me, how have her constituents reacted to all this? Are any of them coming to her defense?
There was a contingency of people who were supportive of Councilwoman Green, who remain steadfast behind her, arguing that she has been maligned and that she is remains a steadfast supporter in the neighborhoods. And if you look at some of her expenditures, a lot of them go to youth organizations. So she certainly has a contingency of people who are still behind her. But there have been more and more people who have stepped back, who want to see what this process, how it will turn out before making any judgments, both council members and political observers alike.
Was it crowded at the hearing?
Pretty much. It was held in the mayor's gallery, which is unusual. It's usually where the mayor mm-hmm. has his press conferences. So members of the council, Council President Jim King was in attendance. Councilwoman Tina Warpew, who's the head of the Government Accountability and Ethics Committee, she was in attendance. Councilwoman Barbara Shanklin and Councilwoman Sherbrand Hamilton were also there. They were there just to observe, they said. And members of the mayor's staff were in and out. You had different members of Metro government, important folks from Metro government, just peeking in to see what was going on. But it was fairly packed for most of the day.
Used to be a courtroom, I believe.
Yes, it's the old courthouse.
That's right, where fiscal court used to meet as well. All right, Philip Bailey, we'll come back to you in just a moment on some other topics. Let's move on to some other big news this week in the metro area, and that has been the weather. Of course, our thoughts go out to those in the South, especially Alabama, where there's been just unbelievable destruction and loss of life. Just saw President Obama touring the area a short while ago. Reminiscent of April 3rd, 1974 for a lot of us. We certainly empathize with our neighbors to the South and wish them well. But we've been dealing with some flooding, mainly here in the Louisville area this week, and several days of torrential rain. Dalton Main, you've been attending briefings with the mayor and MSD officials. And it seems generally that people have been handling the high water well.
Yeah, it's gone pretty well. Wednesday morning was a close call, they said. That was when, you know, all the tributaries and things and channels started to rise and got real close, and I got real worried. But, you know, we set a couple records. You know, first of all, it was the wettest April on record, with I think around 13 inches, and the previous had been 11. And also, I think Bud said this is the first time, Bud Chardine of MSD said mm-hmm. this is the first time they've had all 16 flood pumping stations fully operational. I'm not exactly sure what all that entails, but he said it's the first time we've had all of them running everything they do, and they've all worked out really well. He said everything that was inside the floodplain was protected. Everything that was, you know, inside the flood protection system, you know, that did its job, and it kept everybody, you know, relatively damage free. So,
some flooding people with water in their homes along the river, businesses along the river outside of that flood area, they seem to be taking it in stride.
Mm-hmm.
And Gabe, we've also been following damage throughout the state. It's not limited to the Louisville area. Governor Beshear has asked for a federal disaster declaration.
Yeah, for Western mostly due to Western Kentucky. The governor toured Western Kentucky yesterday around the Paducah-Murray area to look at some of the flooding. Some of that flooding will be alleviated or could be alleviated. We just got word that a federal district judge or a federal judge had ruled that the Army Corps of Engineers is going to be allowed to breach a levee in Western Missouri mm-hmm. or in Southeastern Missouri if they'd like to. It'll flood some farmland, but it will keep some towns from being flooded in Western Kentucky.
And no timetable on getting an answer on that request for federal assistance.
No, they still haven't really tallied how much everything will cost, the cleanup effort, the total cost of the damage, anything along those lines. And it'll partially depend on that. But the governor at first said that he would probably wait to send the letter until more calculations are done, but then decided yesterday to go ahead and send it.
Unfortunately, we've gotten very good at this process over the past couple of years. Lots of disasters that qualify in the federal level. Back here in the Louisville area, of course, we're in the midst of the Kentucky Derby Festival, some events mm-hmm. along the waterfront mm-hmm. affected by this.
Yeah, I just talked with someone over at the Derby Festival, Mark Shalcross, and he said, you know, he reiterated that a lot of things have been moved around, moved to other locations, moved away from the river some. He said they haven't really tallied the attendance numbers yet, haven't taken a look at that, but they're glad that the river is starting to recede now because this is when things start picking up. This is when more people are going to be going down to the riverfront to be getting food, things like that. He said the crowd just before lunch was looking pretty good. And so as long as the weather stays relatively bright and the, you know, not much more rain falls, then they're pretty confident things will start to recover for them.
I think some rain in the forecast again for possibly what, Sunday?
Yeah, this supposed weekend. To start again Sunday through Tuesday, I believe.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens. Back to the tornadoes and the devastation in the South. Dalton, you spoke to a U of L professor this week who says this loss of life that we've seen in the South could be prevented with better preparation. Tell us about that.
Well, he made it very clear that he said it was just unacceptable that this death toll is that high. He said with the improvements in technology, you know, over the last couple decades and everything, he said the numbers have always steadily declined throughout that. And he said they should keep declining. And, you know, what he said is that with the kind of capabilities that media has, with the accessibility, he said everyone should be better prepared. And the thing that he suggested was the thing about the weather alert radios, you know, he said they're very cheap. He said in relation to the cost of the loss of life, he said it's relatively cheap to get these weather radios. And he said it would be a great thing to have the government distribute them to everyone because that, you know, that would be, you know, like I said, in relation to the cost of the loss of life, he said it would be a small cost to do that. So,
and I'm sure we'll be hearing in the weeks to come how prepared they were in Alabama and Georgia and those other places. But from what I've heard so far, the twister just moved through so quickly. There's very little time to react. And even if you had a good place, you weren't necessarily safe.
Yeah, he said that there's always going to be, you know, a certain amount of destruction and loss of life. He said sometimes, you know, it's unavoidable. He said, but in perspective with other natural disasters, mm-hmm. he said this is one that we can foresee, we can prevent somewhat, especially in relation to something like the earthquake that happened in Japan. So, you know, that was his big point. So,
all right. This is State of the News on WFPL, and we're discussing some of the week's events with the WFPL news team, Gabe Bullard, Dalton Main, Philip Bailey. Let's move on to some other developments this week. Gabe, you've been following the Council on Post-Secondary Education's consideration of tuition increase requests from UofL and other institutions. What did the council do?
Yesterday, they voted on caps for tuition increases for the next academic year. UofL and UK will be allowed to raise tuition 6%, which is what they've both planned on doing. The other universities, Eastern, Morehead, will be allowed to raise tuition 5%. Community colleges will be allowed to raise tuition 4%. I talked with Michael Gritton of Kentuckiana Works about this, and he said he understands that tuition has to go up, that the model of education used to be, with public education, used to be everyone contributed in return, they got a more educated workforce, better jobs, things like that. He says that's starting to shift, and now the burden is being placed on the individual more just through government decisions over the last 20, 30 years. And he says he's not trying to stop that. He's not trying to reverse that. But if there is still going to be this benefit of an education to society, of having these public education systems, he says that scholarships, grants, things like that need to be picked up as well, that needs to be expanded. So maybe the taxpayers aren't paying as much for public education, but then the students shouldn't have to pay more necessarily. There should be some scholarships, grants, things along those lines, so someone doesn't have to work 40 hours and go to school at the same time.
This council action is not the final word. Each school's trustees would have to approve the hikes, right?
Yes. Each school is now working on that. At the University of Louisville, they're figuring out how much they want to raise certain fees, other costs associated with going to college. They'll run that by the Board of Trustees, and then they will take that to the council again sometime in June for final approval.
And moving on to another topic, the issue of industrial hemp, Gabe, has come up again, this time in the race for Kentucky Agriculture Commissioner in the primary next month. Kentucky was once a major industrial hemp producer, and some say bring it back, be a good cash crop, but police aren't too keen on the idea.
Yeah, the Republican candidates for Ag Commissioner had both come out in support of it, or at least exploring the idea of growing hemp to bring in more money for the state. The Kentucky State Police has traditionally opposed this. They continue to oppose it. They say they'll enforce whatever happens, but their problem is that hemp is hard to distinguish from marijuana if they're flying over fields, things like that, and they're concerned that someone might try to hide marijuana within a hemp field, and they're not sure how to check for that. There are some federal regulations if Kentucky goes toward growing more industrial hemp. There are federal regulations that would have to apply. And the folks I talked to over at the state police say they would like to see some state regulations as well to make it easier to either find out or to prevent someone from growing marijuana instead of industrial hemp, or to find out if they are.
And this would require, I assume, what would it require to make it legal?
It would be a change in state law, and I believe there would have to be some sort of federal step, at least to go through these regulatory hoops.
All right. Let's turn back to you, Philip. Talk about the Kentucky governor's race. Some developments this week on the Republican side. Lieutenant Governor candidate Richie Farmer had raised some eyebrows when he announced he wouldn't take part in the state furlough program. But now he's changed course somewhat, donating his furlough day salary.
On second thought. Lieutenant Governor gubernatorial candidate Richie Farmer initially had said he just philosophically disagreed with Governor Steve Beshear's plan to save money on the budget. Statewide constitutional officers like the agriculture commissioner, state auditor, attorney general, they're not allowed to change their salaries. So what many of them did was they voluntarily gave up portions of their salaries to participate in furlough days. Mr. Farmer, who makes over $100,000 annually, did not. He decided that he just disagreed with the policy as a whole. But after some mounting political pressure, he reversed that position earlier this week. He said that he will give, he's already given parts of his salary to charity to cover 5 of the 6 furlough days, and he's going to give another portion of his salary to charity to cover the 6th day next month.
What have other state officials done as far as the furlough day? They don't accept their salary, right? Like the governor and so forth?
Yeah, so the governor's participated. You know, Crit Llewellyn has participated. Attorney General Jack Conway and others have participated. But this is something that has been contentious in state government. I mean, there were Democratic members of the House disagreed with Governor Beshear on furlough days. And we remember here in the city when, you know, former Mayor Jerry Abramson suggested furlough days as a cost-cutting measure. So it's not something that people necessarily always come down on one political aisle or the other and fit their party. They often have different opinions that you shouldn't punish workers with furloughs. That's the opinion held by many. But this has continued to put more pressure on Richie Farmer, who initially was going to be, it was thought, was going to be the lighter side, the sunnier side of the campaign in his campaign with State Senate President David Williams. It seems that Mr. Farmer has gotten more and more negative attention for his spending, particularly from his office and certain luxury suites and certain expenditures that he has incurred over that time.
That's a segue. I was going to bring up the luxury suites. This is a hotel bill during the boys' high school basketball tournament. The Commissioner Farmer rented these suites, billed the state for it. He says it's a legitimate expense, but he's getting a lot of criticism about it.
Yeah, the Kentucky Democratic Party has renewed its call, perhaps sensing some political weakness on Mr. Farmer for giving back the money for the furlough days. They have renewed their call that he should repay that, reimburse the taxpayers for that money. I believe it's about $3,000 for those luxury suites from a basketball tournament held in Lexington last month. The KDP points out that Mr. Farmer stayed in the hotel even though it's only 28 miles from his home. The Agricultural Commission's office has argued that Mr. Farmer was advocating for Kentucky Proud, a policy or a program that stresses that people should buy and purchase local foods, healthier foods. So he's continuing to be hammered on that and some of his expenditures, particularly as his divorce records have come out. There's been more scrutiny of Mr. Farmer in this race. He has said publicly that he feels just the media has gotten the story wrong and isn't printing the full story. And the Williams campaign has said that this is just some slimy attacks by the Kentucky Democratic Party to distract people from the issues at hand in the race.
And David Williams is calling on former Mayor Jerry Abramson to do some refunding of his own.
Well, the Republican Party of Kentucky actually made that call. Uh-huh. What they're doing is it's very similar to what the KDP is doing with Mr. Farmer. The Republicans are pointing out, and I expect this will continue, that former Mayor Jerry Abramson, there were some issues with some expenditures during his administration, mainly pointing out that a former special assistant of his, Carol Butler, was paid $85,000 for a part-time job as his special assistant, even though a police investigation of the neighborhoods department revealed that Ms. Butler, according to co-workers, rarely, if ever, showed up to work. The Republican Party has asked that former Mayor Abramson reimburse Louisville taxpayers for that $85,000. The Bashir Abramson campaign has dismissed that, saying that the Republicans are just trying to play tit for tat when it comes to the issues of Mr. Farmer, that they're also doing a distraction. So you're going to see this back and forth. And this is not yet the general election. Let's remind people that we still have the GOP primary that is May 17th. It seems that people are sort of skipping ahead of that, and that the Williams and Bashir campaign are already starting the general election. But this is a preview into if Mr. Williams is to win his primary and face Governor Bashir, this is only a light preview of the mudslinging between both campaigns.
Yeah, we're still early. Williams ahead in the polls, but there's two other Republicans running as well.
Yes, Louisville businessman Phil Moffitt and Jefferson County Clerk Bobby Holtzclaw are running against Mr. Williams in the GOP primary May 17th. There is the speculation that if turnout is lower, that would benefit Mr. Moffitt and Ms. Holtzclaw. But at this point, Mr. Williams has a commanding not only lead in fundraising, but a lead in the polls.
Let's move on. We have a few minutes left on the to the presidential campaign front. You wrote this week, Senator Rand Paul's questioning whether Donald Trump is serious about getting into the presidential race.
Yes. Considering that Senator Paul's father, Congressman Ron Paul, has announced on exploratory committee, Senator Paul on CNN questioned if Donald Trump, the real estate mogul, birther, who President Obama recently criticized as a carnival barker for raising this silly issue about his birth certificate. The issue, I guess, that Rand Paul has with Donald Trump is he doesn't think he's a serious candidate. He compared him, saying he was a comedian or an entertainer. This stems from the fact that Donald Trump did criticize Ron Paul at a recent conservative conference, saying that Ron Paul had no chance of winning. That's what many Republicans have said. But Rand argues that his father, has he won elections before as a congressman, but that the political atmosphere has shifted in order to help him and perhaps boost his chances to be president.
Now, Rand Paul was, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's interesting in Rand Paul's criticisms of Donald Trump, too, in New Hampshire. He came out almost sounding like a protector of the Tea Party, too, and saying, you know, don't be fooled by him, more or less.
Yeah, pointing out that Mr. Trump had given money to Democrats in the past. And Donald Trump is not a full-blown conservative. I mean, he says that he is pro-choice. Mm-hmm. He has supported Democrats in the past, based in New York City. So I don't think it's a clear cut. The only reason that Mr. Trump is considered a conservative, I guess, or a contender is because he continuously hits on this birther issue, even though that has put him at the fringes of American political spectrums.
Now, Rand Paul had flirted with the idea of running for president, but now that his father's running, he's
yeah, now
out.
The dad's in. You know,
I guess he could be his running mate.
Is that legal?
Paul and Paul. I don't know if it is or not.
We need to check.
Honestly,
sure.
I don't
Fact
know.
Check.
If they're from different states, I think so. There's,
yeah, I guess a father and son could run as president and vice president.
Yeah.
And then there's another Paul sibling that was flirting with the idea of running for office.
Yeah,
right?
Robert Paul, yeah. A physician in Texas, he decided he's not going to run. There could have possibly been three Pauls in Congress. He decided to pull out. He's not saying whether he will run in the future, but he said he was flattered by the overture, but that he is not yet ready to throw his name to replace Kay Bailey Hutchinson in Texas.
All right, plenty more to come. And Dalton, before we go to break, I want to talk about another story you did this week. There was an audit of Kentucky Fish and Wildlife, that agency, regarding a luxury suite at Louisville Slugger Field. What's going on there?
Well, the auditor's office and the auditor's report criticized the Department of Fish and Wildlife for spending, what they called public money on. Part of it was a $3,900 luxury suite at Louisville Slugger Field for the bat season last year. It was four games. And Fish and Wildlife defended it. They said, you know, this was all promotional. It got our name out there. They have a new program called the Fins Program, which is fishing in neighborhoods. And it targets, people who live in urban areas who still like to get outdoors. And they stock, urban ponds and lakes. And he said this was a great place to target people in urban areas who like to get outdoors. And so he said this was, this was good. It benefited us a lot. And the main concern that the auditor's office had with it was that there wasn't a clear documentation of the benefits. And that's what they said they wanted to encourage, was a clear documentation of the benefits for something like this. And the thing that the Fish and Wildlife pointed out is that this isn't tax money that they get. They don't get any tax money. Everything that they have to work with is money that comes in from hunting and fishing licenses. And so they said, you know, we weren't just taking taxpayer dollars and paying for this. But they also said they had they went through with a UofL partnership, a promotional partnership for the football and basketball games. And I think they changed their plan a little bit with this. Instead of keeping the luxury suites and the tickets, they gave away all the tickets to the UofL games to anybody who applied for them on their website. So,
right. Great reporting as always, and a great wrap-up here on Friday. Thanks again to Gabe Bullard, Philip Bailey, and Dalton Main from the WFPL Newsroom. Guys, I'll see you shortly.
Thanks,
Ray. Thanks
for
joining us.
See ya.
Coming up, we'll get an update on local education matters with Tony Kahns of the Courier-Journal. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News on WFPL. We turn our focus now to some Jefferson County education matters. And joining us is Tony Kahns with the Courier-Journal. Tony, welcome back to WFPL.
Thank you.
Let's start with the latest on the plan to fix some struggling Jefferson County public schools that we've heard a lot about recently. This week, the Kentucky Department of Education approved the district's plan to that effect.
Correct. This is the plan. These are called under No Child Left Behind.
Right.
These are Title I funds that go to schools. There are several pots of money out there for the school system to get to fix its schools. There's this big pot of about $4 million, and then there's also a school improvement grant fund, which that has not yet been approved. That's an additional $14 million that'll go to the district's persistently low-achieving schools. And they're still kind of waiting on that. But this particular issue, or this particular chunk of money, this pot of money, was an issue because twice the district's application was rejected by the state for several issues. The district basically redid their application, met the concerns of the state and the commissioner, and the state notified them that it had in fact been approved, and now the money will start flowing into the district. They're going to do things like hire coaches and things like that. This is money that goes directly to the district, not to the schools. There's other Title I money that goes directly to schools. This is particularly district money.
I see. Oh, what's in the plan? Are they replacing some teachers and that sort of thing?
Not necessarily replacing teachers. That would be the restaffing options. That's all school improvement grant money.
Right.
This particular plan is more of a district-wide effort. They may hire an academic coach like in math and reading, money that the district will provide, and then place teachers, professional development for teachers, bringing them in, giving them more training in particularly troubled areas, reading and math in particular, because that's the whole focus of behind No Child Left Behind. Any kind of instructional assistance that they feel might be necessary, they can use that money for that.
Now, State Education Commissioner Terry Holliday, on a kind of a related note, had earlier recommended the district bring in a consultant And this was to help with test scores, right?
Correct. Yeah, this is the guy out of North Carolina.
Right.
And there's been a little controversy about that as well. He wants him to kind of come in as kind of a, I don't know what, I guess you could call it an academic coach for the district.
Right.
Obviously, there's some issues with that because, you know, we're in the middle of a superintendent search here, and there's been some, you know, from the school board's approach, you know, standpoint, they're not really sure if they want to get somebody in. And then in addition, then bring in a superintendent, you know, brand new with this particular person. So that's kind of up in the air right now. But Dr. Holliday is wanting the district to have somebody to kind of, you know, who he feels has experience in turning around, you know, low performing schools, particularly in urban city districts, and to kind of provide some assistance to Jefferson County.
And this is an expensive consultant, but it would be a limited number of hours.
Correct. Yes.
I forget how much.
I can't remember off the top of my head.
Be a total of a couple of $100,000
yes,
altogether.
Yes, correct. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Speaking of consultants, and we'll go down with the superintendent search in a moment, but Dr. Gary Orfield, we've heard a lot about, was brought in from California to assess the student assignment plans. And he's still at work on this?
That's correct. I just talked to Rosemary Miller, who's the general counsel for the school board, at the last school board meeting this Monday. And she says that the plan is he's still working on, you know, putting together his recommendations, his plans. They expect to hear something within the next 4 to 6 weeks. I expect probably by the end of May. In the meantime, you also have this transportation consultant that was hired. I expect that plan to come a little bit before the Orfield, but both of those are kind of intermingled. So I don't know if they're going to present them all at once because one has a lot to do with the other. I'm not sure how they're going to lay those out.
Now, Dr. Orfield had recommended that the board wait to implement the middle school assignment plan, but they declined to do that, right?
That's right. It was a split vote. This is a split issue for the school board. There are some board members that feel that they should have waited because they're very, very concerned about the start of the school year. As you know, and as a lot of people in the community know, there was a somewhat of a problem last school year with lots of kids not getting home on time. And so the big concern for the school board, and I've heard this many times reiterated, is they're just very, very concerned about the start of school, and they don't want to put any additional pressure on their transportation department with a new plan. But the board voted, and it was a majority vote, to go ahead and move forward with the middle school plan this fall. High school, yeah, high schools will be the following fall.
I see. And the elementary plan has been in place, 2 years now?
Correct. This will be the third year. And coincidentally, those student assignment letters, parents have been getting a lot of calls about that. They're going out this week. So for parents of new students to the district in kindergarten and first graders, your letters should be in the mail. You probably will be getting them today or tomorrow.
And on the transportation issue, of course, we remember back in August, some kids didn't get home until after 9 o'clock. There were some serious problems with it. Are they still going to purchase some new radios for?
Yes, there's actually two things that they've done. There's a couple of things that they've done, but in terms of money-wise, they did buy some new radios. Coincidentally, there's been some new changes with federal regulations that they had to get some different radios in. And in the meantime, they had some of these radios that were 20, 25 years old. So they went ahead and spent, I think it was about $1.5 million for radios for all of their buses. They're actually in the process of putting into the buses this week. In addition, the budget, which will be up for approval in May, they're putting GPS systems on buses, which they think will also help. And of course, it won't be in time for the start of this school year, but it's another $1.5 million that'll come out of the general fund. And I think that's going to help assist to make sure people, you know, buses are doing what they're supposed to be doing and taking the most efficient routes and whatnot.
Well, let's talk about the search for a new superintendent. The board, of course, decided late last year to replace Dr. Sheldon Berman. Been here 4 years. Search is on for a new leader. Where do we stand with that?
Well, I talked to school board chairman Steve Imhoff at the school board meeting on Monday. He says as of Monday, there were 10 to 15 people who've already put their applications in. Obviously, he wouldn't tell me who they were. I've heard, you know, as I'm sure a lot of people have, rumors as to who's put their name in the hat. The field doesn't actually close until May 18th, so there's actually, you know, 3 more weeks. I know from previous experience that a lot of people don't apply until the last possible minute. Just, you know, a lot of times they wait. From there, you know, it's going to move pretty quick. After once the 18th comes, they're going to move pretty quickly. They would like to have somebody in place by July 1, but obviously we're looking at a 6-week period from the time, you know, the application period closes to the time that they want somebody in the seat. So they have been talking about the possibility of getting an interim person to serve in that position until the permanent person can come in. There has been no action on that. They met in closed session for about 45 minutes on Monday night. They came out, no action was taken, and they will discuss it at their next meeting, which will be the second Monday in May.
I'm asking you to speculate, but do you suspect this would be someone within the system?
I don't know. I'm not real sure. In the interim, you're talking?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, I'm not real sure. You know, there are a couple of requirements. They have to have a certification, a specific administrative certification. There are a few people in the district that have that. I'm not, you know, I think there's a few people who have expressed interest in it, but I have not really been privy to names and just other than, you know, hearing what right. people are saying.
Well, in the meantime, Dr. Berman has accepted a job in Oregon, right?
Correct, in Eugene, Oregon. And it's a smaller, much smaller district. It's a lot different than Jefferson County. And his last day in JCPS will be June 30th, and I believe he starts on the job there July 1st.
Wow.
So I'm sure he has a little vacation time. You know, I'm not totally sure when his last day, you know, physically in the district will be, but his contract ends on June 30th.
Is there anything he wants to accomplish between now and then? I know he's submitted a budget to the board.
Yeah, he's been pretty gung-ho on the budget and making sure that things in the budget. They've already approved a tentative, and you know, this is the budget in May will be the actual budget that'll go in place on July 1st. You know, student assignment, he's really been working big on the school improvement grant money to make sure that the school gets that. Just basically kind of keeping things running the way they are. I don't see any new initiatives coming or anything like that, other than he wants to expand the number of school nurses, which has been his thing for the last three or four years. But other than that, it's pretty much cut and dry budget stuff.
All right. Well, Tony Kahns with the Courier-Journal, thanks for joining us and give us this update on education here in Jefferson County.
Thank you.
Good to see you again. Probably run into you at the next board meeting.
I'm sure you will.
Tony Kahns. Thank you. Tony Kahns with the Courier-Journal. Coming up next, Matt Tully with the Indianapolis Star joins us to talk about the Indiana General Assembly, which wraps up tonight. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News on WFPL. Today is the final day of the 2011 Indiana General Assembly. And what a session it has been. It included a five-week walkout by House Democrats upset with the Republican majority's agenda, especially related to labor issues. Lawmakers passed ambitious education agenda, the agenda pushed by Governor Mitch Daniels, a Republican. And bubbling in the background of all this is the possibility that Daniels might seek the Republican nomination for president next year. And soldiering through all this has been Matt Tully with the Indianapolis Star. Matt, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, today is the last day of the session. As we speak around midday, what's left on the agenda for lawmakers to consider?
Well, pretty much just the state budget, the new two-year budget. Now, that, as is often the case, that includes just about everything they've been debating all year. Often what happens is they toss everything into the state budget, even if it's unrelated to what you would expect. So a lot of the education reform issues find their way in there. A lot of other things find their way into the budget. But the most important thing is just a template for how they're going to spend billions of dollars over the next 2 years.
Now, there have been some disagreement between the House and Senate on if there is a big surplus, how they would handle that, send it back to the taxpayers or use it some other way. Has that been settled yet?
Yeah, they pretty much split the difference. It's one of those, you always have to have something to fight about at the end. And I found it pretty funny that people were getting all worked up about whether they were going to settle this deal when, you know, Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. I was pretty sure they were going to solve this little impasse, and the fact that that's all they were arguing over told you, you know, how obvious it was. So pretty much, if you reach that point where you have such a huge surplus that you can't possibly sit on the money, they're going to split the money between paying down pension debt and shooting taxpayers a refund check.
And the latest revenue forecast, a little rosier this time around, a little extra money included in the budget.
Yeah, it's been rough for so long here, but you've started to get some nice revenue figures. It allowed the governor to largely fulfill his campaign promise of funding full-day kindergarten universally around the state. So that was the big news at the end of the session, and a sign that while the recovery hasn't been as robust as people would hope, it's definitely better than it was a year or two ago.
Now, there were concerns after that walkout by House Democrats that they wouldn't get caught up in time. Might be a need for a special session, but it looks like they'll be ready to go tonight.
You know, if anything, I think this just should make us question whether we need such a long session. If they could take a month and a half off in the middle and still get things done in time, maybe the session's too long. There's always something in the middle of the session. This one was slightly more dramatic because they left the state and closed down the House for 5 or 6 weeks, but there's always something in the middle. There's always some impasse. There's always some stalemate, and they always work it out. It happens year after year after year. So I know it made for good headlines and political chatter, but in the end, I think everyone knew they were going to find a way to get things worked out.
Now, speaking of the walkout, there was, I think last week, an attachment, I believe, in the Senate to the budget that would allow a citizen to file suit against a boycotting lawmaker, and the fine would be, about $1,000 or so. Is that still in the mix?
It is. They put that in there, and as long as Democrats show up tonight and vote on the final budget, that'll become the law. And that's interesting. I think that might just eliminate the whole, at least the long walkouts. I think it kicks in after they've been gone, shut down the session for 3 days, or if they do it on the last day of the session. So, first of all, I don't know if it's legal. It'll be interesting to see if Democrats are just taking it right now and then file a challenge to it, because honestly, I don't know that you can, I'm not a lawyer, but it sure sounds slightly questionable to me. But if it is, it might end this longstanding practice we've had of one party or the other, when they don't like what's going on, just getting up and going home.
Now, they were fined this time around, weren't they, for the walkout?
They were. I think they in the end, they raised it to $350 a day. So it added up over time, because they didn't start the fining right at the beginning. They started with smaller fines and worked their way up. I believe it came out to about $3,500 per Democratic lawmaker.
And in some cases, those are forgiven, but not this time, right?
Exactly. They typically have been forgiven as part of the process of getting them back to work. But Speaker Brian Bosma, a Republican speaker, insisted or promised his caucus that he would not back down this time. They were pretty furious that Democrats left the state and shut things down just because they didn't like the bills Republicans were pushing with their majority. And Speaker Bosma would have taken a lot of heat from conservatives in this state who did not want to see those fines waived. So they actually changed the rules to make it pretty hard to waive those fines.
Now, something else that raised the hackles of Democrats is a provision, I believe, attached to an election bill that would allow the governor to name a replacement for Secretary of State Charlie White. There's no other issue that took place during the session. If he's ruled ineligible to hold office, he's under indictment for voter fraud. Now, is that still being considered?
Yes, it's going to become law, but they've solved the questionable part of it by making it not making it retroactive, so it only applies to future elections. So it wouldn't apply to Charlie White. It was clearly bad form to on the Republicans' part to try to save face here and make sure they can get their own person in by trying to change the law while their own party member is under indictment. So they were very smart to back off that and make it. It's a good change. It'll help in the future, but it's not something that you want to do after the fact. So they backed off for now and solved that. Would have been a pretty big political embarrassment, I think.
For those who don't know, Charlie White under indictment for using, correct me if I'm wrong, a wrong address on his voter registration material.
Yeah, he was indicted on 7 counts of voter fraud, misleading authorities. He was a town councilman in the town of Fishers before he became Secretary of State, and he was divorced and moved well across the other side of town, but continued to serve in his old council district, even though he didn't live there anymore, and then went and continued to vote in his new precinct, in his old precinct, even though he clearly did not live in that, didn't even live within miles of that precinct. And what's obviously most embarrassing about this is that he's now the state's chief elections officer.
And I think the governor asked him to step down, but he has declined.
Just about everyone has, including the governor of his own party. And he's just said no, and there's not a whole lot they can do until the criminal proceedings work their way through the system. If he's convicted of a felony, he's out of a job. Republicans would clearly like to see that happen, him leave on his own before that, but he's stubbornly refused to do so.
And if he has to leave office, it would be assumed by the Democrat who in the election?
That is a little unclear right now how that's going to work. Whether it's going to be a new election or the Democrat. That's going to be really interesting to watch. The Democrat, who didn't even come close in the election, lost by I think 300,000 or 400,000 votes. He's actually running for Indianapolis City Council and is most likely going to win because he's got the party endorsement and it's a Democratic district. So it'll be interesting. And here in Marion County, Indianapolis, people are kind of excited about him because he's, you know, we've had troubles attracting high-caliber council candidates, and he's a pretty high-caliber council candidate. So I think in Indianapolis, people want him to serve on the council.
Vop Ossoli is his name. I should pass that along. One of the great names in politics.
Oh, yeah. His campaign yard signs say, "Vote Vop." And you can't buy that kind of publicity.
Oh, that's great. Back to the General Assembly for a moment. An abortion bill passed this week that was very controversial. It cuts off funding to Planned Parenthood, places more restrictions on women seeking abortions. Now, the governor has not signed it yet. Does he plan to do that?
Good question. He's mulling it over. He supports. He's made clear that he supports what was originally in the bill, the new restrictions on abortion and that kind of stuff. What he hasn't taken a position on publicly is the Planned Parenthood cuts, which would not only cut off federal funding that goes through the state to Planned Parenthood, but would also cost the state a lot of money in federal dollars. They would lose money here. In addition to that, it's obviously being watched very closely because of the presidential ramifications. If you're Daniels and you're thinking about running for the Republican nomination and you veto a bill that would cut off funding for Planned Parenthood, that could be the end of your hopes in GOP caucus states and in early primary states. So everyone's watching that to see what he's going to do. It's very interesting that he hasn't taken a position on the Planned Parenthood part of the bill so far. That bill's caused a lot of consternation in the state, a lot of critics of what they're doing, and a lot of concerns about what it will mean for women's health. So it's one that I'm eagerly waiting to see what Daniels does.
If he does sign it, Planned Parenthood is threatening a lawsuit, right?
Yes, exactly. And you know, I think it's not going to end one way or the other with the bill being signed.
Well, let's talk about his education agenda in the last few minutes we have here. That was, of course, at the top of his wish list at the beginning of the session, and it looks like he pretty much got what he wanted.
He got just about everything he wanted, big and little. You know, I guess it's the benefit of having your party control everything and control it in a big way. They have 60 of 100 seats in the House and 37 of 50 seats in the Senate. So it wasn't too hard, especially since he and Tony Bennett, who is the education secretary, have spent a couple years leading up to this making the case for why they should do this. They were going to make this push no matter what happened with the elections last year, made it a whole lot easier to get it done with majority, but created a voucher program. More charter schools are going to come online. Collective bargaining for teachers has not been wiped out like some governors in other states have proposed, but it has been severely curtailed. They can negotiate wages and benefits going forward, and that's about it. Then there's teacher accountability provisions that are going to change the way teachers are evaluated, a merit pay system. As I mentioned earlier, he did include funding for full-day kindergarten in there to finish that job, which he'd started a few years ago, and governors going back 20 years have talked about, so that finally got done. But it's easily the most sweeping education reform package in probably the state's history.
And this school voucher program will be the largest in the country?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it works. I know the teachers unions and a lot of others are up in arms about it. It's going to be really interesting to see how many parents take advantage of that and what that does at the local level. Obviously, here in Indianapolis, it doesn't get much bigger than education as far as issues that affect the city. All you have to do is drive around to the suburbs and ask people why they moved out of Indianapolis, and most likely they'll tell you because of the schools. So it's a huge issue here. I'm not convinced, and a lot of people aren't convinced that the voucher issue is going to have that big of an impact. There so far isn't a whole lot of evidence that parents have been lining up desperately trying to get into private school, especially now that they have charter options and things like that. But we'll see. Within 2 or 3 years, I think we're going to really be able to see if all these reforms that have been pushed in recent years that a lot of advocates from Governor Daniels to Barack Obama talk about, whether they have the impact that people hope they have.
About 20 seconds left. When's the governor going to announce if he's going to run for president?
Well, not this weekend. He told us that. And that's as far as he goes. This is a guy who, boy, he keeps things about as close to the vest as any politician I've seen. The best guess, though, is clearly within the next 2 weeks, sometime between Monday and the following Friday. There are a couple dates where he has big events. The big Republican state dinner is on May 12th here in Indianapolis, and he goes to Washington, D.C. on May 4th. So we'll see. My guess is, however he does it, it's going to be kind of a surprise. It's not going to leak out before he wants it leaked out.
All right, we'll be watching. Matt Tully with the Indianapolis Star, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
That's all the time we have for State of the News. Thanks again to Tony Kahns of the Courier-Journal. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff, some of whom you heard on today's program, including Gabe Bullard, Philip M. Bailey, Dalton Main, Graham Shelby, Laura Ellis, Brad Yost. And joining us soon will be Erica Peterson, our new environment reporter. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us Monday through Thursday at the 1 p.m. for Here and Now, and each Friday at 1 for State of the News on WFPL.